Si Ota Ofa, everyone, and this is Richard. Welcome to the Q&A for episode 3. I had the opportunity to meet some of you over the weekend at the Manhattan concert, so that was cool, and I'm just so thankful for all of your compliments and some of the feedback that you've given me. I'm so appreciative of the support from just all across the spectrum, and so I can't tell you enough how thankful I am for all of you. Once again, if you have questions for the podcast, please send it to my email, rwolfgram@gmail.com. That is rwolfgram@gmail.com. Or we're going to do something different. Don't leave me a voicemail on the Anchor app because there's a time limit on it. Instead, call this. It's my Google voice number. I created it just for this. The number is 385-347-0906. Once again, 385-347-0906. And just leave me a voicemail, and I would love to answer your question in future episodes. Our first question comes from Ailine. And also, this is a question that I have, and this is about the usage of Si Ota Ofa, and also the practice of Hongi, which are both no longer practiced in Tongan culture. If you remember in the previous episode, we learned about Ahoetu, the first Tu'itonga. He wanted to search for his father, and his mother told him to climb up the Toa tree into the heavens, and he will find his father. And when his father first sees him, he greets him with a hongi, and also he says Si Ota Ofa. Also remember that when they first brought Mariner to the court, or to the residence of Finaulukalala II, the women in the court, they looked at him and they pitied him, and the greeting they also had for him was Si Ota Ofa. So we turn to one of my favorite people, and also a cousin of mine, Tevita Ka'ili. Dr. Ka'ili is a dean and also a professor of cultural anthropology in Brigham Young University, Hawaii, and he'll introduce himself in this call. So enjoy. All right. On the phone with me, I have Professor Tevita Osoni Ka'ili, and he is currently the Dean of Faculty of Culture, Language, and Performing Arts, and a professor of cultural anthropology at Brigham Young University, Hawaii. And I just want to give some time for you, Tevita, to introduce yourself to our audience.
Thank you, Si Ota Ofa. Thank you, Shete, for this opportunity. And I'm a big fan of your podcast. Just to introduce myself, I am, my family are from different parts of Tonga. My father is from Kolonga in Tongatapu, but also Maofanga, and that's his paternal side. And the mother's side is from Pangai, Hapai, Whakakakai, and also Ha'ano. And then on my mother's side is my her father is from Koloa. Koloa, that's the same place where Richard Lisate is from, but yeah. Also, yes, Koloa people, yeah. But also from Tuanuku and Neyafu in that side. So those are all the places that I'm from in Tonga.
Oh, thank you. Your grandmother is a true Vava'uan.
Yes, true Vava'u. Everyone from Koloa, they're from the true people. And, you know, there's a lot of stories about Koloa in many of our ancient stories.
Why I have Tevita here is because we have a lot of you who have sent questions to the podcast. Several of you have sent questions about the greeting Si Ota Ofa. And we talked about this in the second episode. If y'all remember when William Mariner was brought to the residence of Finaulukalala, that's how he was greeted by his wives and attendants, is that they went up to this young mariner after he was cleaned up and made presentable for Finaulukalala, and the greeting they gave him was Si Ota Ofa, and really just a lot of it almost sounded like they pitied him. And so I heard this term first, if you remember, Devita, when we went to the Tongan History Conference in New Zealand in 2013. Do you remember, you were at that conference? No? Yes or no?
No, I was there at the same time, but I was at a different conference.
Oh, okay.
You and Anabesi were in that particular conference.
Yeah, and that's where I first heard the term, si ota ofa, and then I just noticed that there's been a big push for it with Tongan Language Week in New Zealand. And so if you can just give us, share with us just some of your knowledge of si ota ofa, from what we understand, was the old greeting, and, you know, now it's malo elele. But if you can just share with us what you know about this, the old greeting, why don't we use it anymore? And we'll start from there.
Okay, thank you. So si ota ofa, that's our ancient Tongan greeting, and it's a more warmer, affectionate way of greeting somebody, literally, basically say, you know, my love to you, or, you know, my love towards you. That's more of a way. And we use ofa in, you know, and many other parts of Polynesia use that particular term in, you know, in aloha or aroha or alofa, which is their version of ofa. And actually our Tongan equivalent of all of that is aloofa. But that's used mainly just for the chiefly class or the royal family. But going back to si ota ofa, so si ota ofa, to my knowledge, the first time it was used in one of our oral tradition. And the oral tradition is basically the story about Maui Atalanga. This is the time, according to the oral tradition, that the sky was so close to the land and people were crawling. And one day, Maui Atalanga came from Lalofonua, which is the underworld, and noticed that people were just still crawling because the sky was too close. And he saw this woman carrying a hohoni, which is a coconut flask with water. And he greeted the woman. And this is what he said. He said, si ota ofa fifine. This is from the Masiu Moala version of this story. So this is where I first saw somebody using the words si ota ofa in our story. So according to the story, this happened in Koroa, because the Maui Atalanga and of course his son Maui Kisikisi, they lived in Koloa and then went to the underworld Lalofonua, and they did their plantation and farming there. So that's where where I first noticed in our tradition where si ota ofa done by Maui Atalanga in Koloa. So there you go, Koloa people. The other time is when Aho Eitu went to visit his father, Tangaloa Eitu Matupua. And when they first greeted each other, Tangaloa Eitu Matupua said si ota ofa. And so that was a sort of a later time, but you can see that greeting was also used. And what's interesting is because our oral tradition still preserve this sort of greeting.
Right.
The words are still, so when you tell the story of Maui Atalanga, you know, saying si ota ofa to the woman, you can see that it's there. And then, you know, after that, the woman basically asked him if he can push up the sky. He pushed up the sky. That's what he said. And then with Tangaloa, that's what Tangaloa said to his son, Ao Eitu. And then another tradition where I saw si ota ofa was also in the tradition of Fevanga and Fefafa. So in Fevanga and Fefafa, these are the couple that live in Eweki. And in the stories that the king came by and wanted to look for food, but then you have any food. So, you know, they ended up, you know, baking their own daughter Kava in the umu. But they said si ota ofa to each other in that tradition too. Yeah, Fevanga actually said si ota ofa. So we have a lot of tradition that have this. So the record is there. And even if you go back to our original dictionary, so the first Tongan dictionary was done in 1845 by Reverend Stephen Rabone. And he has it there, si ota ofa, and it's defined as a Tongan salutation. And later on, Baker had a dictionary in 1897, and si ota ofa is there. But after that, it did not appear in the dictionary 1950 by Churchwood. So somehow the words sort of kind of fell out of
changed,
use after
yeah.
that. But before then, that was the greeting for Tongans.
Do you have any insights as to when and why that changed to what we have today?
I have no insight. I don't know why that changed or what was the reasoning behind that. Because, you know, even Maloy Lele, I don't even see anyone using Maloy Lele in our old tradition. So I think that might have come, you know, that may be just an invention that somebody used later. I do know that the word Malo, you know, like people will say this to each other, Malo et Aulava, Malo. So that seems to be an older tradition, but that, you know, I'm not sure exactly what happened there, why that changed.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Do you feel one particular way or another to the usage of Si Oto Ofa or Maloy Lele? And what camp are you on? Because I notice there's people in the Tongan community that want to bring Si Oto Ofa back.
Yeah, yeah. I use both, you know, because I understand that language change and people use it, but I really like using Si Oto Ofa, especially when I'm, you know, talking to people that are close friends of mine. So, Augustino, Hufanga Augustino Mahina and I, we email, and there's a group of us scholars that email each other, and our emails as always starts with Si Oto Ofa. Mm. Sort of, you know, we're close, and that
yeah.
seems to be a much more affectionate and warmer way of saying Si Oto Ofa. And I just love that Ofa is in there because, you know, Ofa and all the other, you know, Moana or Polynesian words that are associated, you know, the idea is that Ofa is more about, you know, sharing, because from Augustino Mahina's work, which I agree, he thinks that the term actually emerged when we were sailing in our long distance voyages. And when we had to share our scarce resources with one another, that was Ofa. You know, just that sort of kind of sharing and caring for one another. That was Ofa, and that's where the sort of the term emerged from. And so, you know, almost all of our, you know, our cousins, still use the term, today.
Okay. So let's talk about the Hongi because
yeah.
In previous episodes and in our reading of the book, we read that, you know, when Mariner was presented to Finau'ulukalala II, kind of like his court, he was greeted with a hongi. And then we read also in that same legend that you mentioned of Aho'eitu,
mm-hmm.
and when he went to the heavens to look for his father, in addition to being greeted with Si Oto Ofa, he was also greeted with a hongi.
Yeah.
And so we have evidence that Tongans used to hongi, and we don't anymore. So do you
yeah.
have any information on that you can share with us?
Well, we still do it. It's just that we do it on the cheek.
Right.
and so we have a reformed version of the hongi, but you can still see that when Tongans see each other,
yeah.
Well, you know, after a long time, we, you know, we call it feilaki now, but traditionally the hongi, our term for hongi was fekita.
Mm.
So that was our sort of word. Maybe we had a word that was similar to hongi, but the tradition that I've seen, that seemed to be the word that used in our oral tradition. So when
fekita,
fekita, yeah, which is when, our aid went up to meet his father, Tangaloa, that was what the tradition said. It was fekita, which was basically pressing noses.
Pressing noses,
a
yes.
Of, yeah, mm-hmm. as a
ah.
form of greeting. There are some scholars who think that this all, that during the time when, you know, there were some challenges that were happening in Tonga or during the time when there were other diseases that were spreading that the missionaries sort of discouraged. And I also know from the missionaries' journals that many of them were sort of uncomfortable with the whole idea of homies, because I read some of their journals where they said, oh no, I have to go and press gnosis with the native and I don't want to. So I know that it was the influence of the missionaries that sort of kind of said we shouldn't do this, and that's why we are now using a sort of a version of it,
which yeah.
is the Beilaki and the cheek.
The sniffing of the cheek, which makes so much sense now why, you know, you Beilaki with somebody and you get like a deep whiff on the side of your face.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's our modified version of the Hongi or Fekita.
Yes, or Fekita. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Our modified version of it. But, you know, there are people who are reviving this, you know, the Maoris, they kept it for, you know, all these years and they did the Hongi. And here in Hawaii, it's becoming much more common. The Hawaiians are reviving it, you know, and they call it Honi here in Hawaii. There are other traditions where the Honi was not nose to nose, but touching sides of the nose. And some Hawaiians believe that was also practiced here. But still, the nose was important in that particular form of greeting.
Yeah. Do you have any idea why? Why the nose?
Well, I think that part of it was the sort of kind of, the scent of one another was important, and the scent for us in the Moana or Moana Nui was always important for us to have to sort of kind of take that smell in of the other person, because we have a lot of songs that talks about the smell of the flower and the smell of, you know, different materials, including ngatu, you know, the word for ngatu, which is comes from ngangatu, which is the smell of the tapa. I think for us, that was important part of sort of identifying a person and knowing a person by knowing them through their scent. That was important. Now, there is other people who says, you know, it was part of like sharing the ha, you know, that I'm not sure about that. That might be more of a, you know,
new age,
new age way
yeah.
of that. I don't know quite. Yeah, but I know for sure that, you know, smelling and sort of kind of getting the scent of other people was very important for us because we have lots of songs about it.
Yeah.
And that would be one, because I think you do identify a person and you sort of kind of know them through their scent, in you know, in our Moana tradition.
Yeah. That is so fascinating. This is the first time I've heard that. So I am learning something new. And this kind of makes sense because, you know, in the book, Mariner talks about how he was just amazed at how Tongans were so fond of bathing
and
talked about how some of them bathe 3-4 times a day.
Exactly.
So,
and we had, you know, all different kinds of oil that we had that we used in Tonga. And we were so, you know, kakala, we were almost sort of obsessed with the kakala because the flowers, right?
Yeah.
That was so important in our culture to identify them and to know them and even to rank them, right?
Right.
So a person's scent or just that was always important for our culture.
Well, I think, is there anything else you want to add that we haven't mentioned?
I just want to say that, you know, we Tongans have such a very complicated pronouns. So si oto is my, right? That's sort of the way that you say my, but it's a particular sort of saying it. So you can say hoku, which is more ordinary, but once you add the word si to it, it's a more emotional way of saying it. So si oto or si oku, these are more emotional sort of a way with emotion.
Poetic,
so it's not only poetic, yes, very much poetic, but it adds feelings to it.
Mm-hmm.
So our pronouns has these way of like making distinction between just regular, ordinary way of saying things, that this is my hoku, versus Sioku or Sioto. Yeah, exactly. And if this is one of the most difficult part of learning Tongan, because when you learn Tongans, you see that Tongans have many, many levels of pronouns that they use in the way that they, classify things. You know, when do you use hoku and eku and so forth?
Yeah.
Those, it's harder for people to understand just because of our very complex way of using pronouns.
Yeah. Which makes the case, an even stronger case for us to bring it back and the usage of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because the thing I really love about it, especially now that you mentioned that, is that you are acknowledging the entire presence of whoever it is that you are greeting. So it's not just that, you know, I see you there, but it's, to me, it feels like there's more of a spiritual depth to it.
Yeah.
So you're acknowledging them physically, but also spiritually, emotionally. Yeah.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
And so I think that's so beautiful. Our indigenous ways are very beautiful.
Yes. And you know that sort of knowledge is carried in our language, and that's part of why it's important to revive our language and try to learn as much as we can about our language, because that's sort of a whole different, you know, view of the world or a different cosmology of the world, where we see the world in ways that you may not see it in sort of in the English tradition. And I think all languages have their own particular way of allowing us to see the world in that culture. And Tongan is that way. I mean, you know, we could have say, you know, Kohoku Ofa, but you know, Sioto Ofa or has these very emotional, spiritual dimension to it. Yeah.
Thank you so much. I think this is a very enlightening call, and I've learned certainly a lot of new things tonight. So hopefully, not hopefully, I know our audience will too. So thank you so much, Atevita, for contributing to this little podcast.
Well, thank you, Lisate. I'm a big fan. I listen to all your podcasts, and thank you for educating our youth and just sharing that knowledge. And using this platform or this medium to share our history, our culture, I think this is the right time to do it. And I will continue to listen. And if you invite me back later at some point, I'd be happy to come back and make a contribution.
I was just going to say there's no if about it. I would love to have you back. So thank you so much. And just thank you for making yourself available with, you know, all that knowledge. And I know you're busy with your work, but you made the time for our audience. So thank you so much.
Okay. Aloha,
Pito. Malo.
Okay, the next question we have. Richard, what is the song you play in the opening of your podcast, and how come it sounds Samoan? Okay, very good question. So the track that I play at the beginning of the podcast is the Me'etu Paki. And it's a chant to a dance that is one of the dances that have survived over time, and it goes back to the Tu'itonga days. And probably I would even say it precedes the Tu'itonga days, because yes, you are right in that it sounds Samoan, because there's a lot of words in it that are could be Tongan or could be Samoan. It could be old Tongan, but it also could be a reflection of the Tu'imanu'a time, when Tu'imanu'a had a strong presence in Tonga. The Me'etu Paki itself is an actual prayer. This is what I understand from Professor Futahelu, the late Futahelu, who he came through Salt Lake City back in, oh gosh, the early 2000s, I believe, and I got to spend time hanging out with Professor Futahelu, his children who came with him. They were all a part of AFPA, which was the Atenisi Atenisi Foundation for Performing Arts. And I learned a lot about just the old Tongan dances, such as the Me'etupaki, the Otuhaka, and even a dance we don't do anymore, the Me'elaufola, from Futahelu. And from what I understand, this was an ancient prayer. This was a prayer that navigators would say before they would embark on a voyage. And in this chant are the names of the old Tongan gods. And so they would say this prayer, this chant, and invoke the name of the old Tongan gods. So there's the gods of the winds, there's the gods of the seas. Basically, it's a prayer for them to have favorable conditions for voyaging. The other theory is that the Me'etu'upaki was a dance that originated in Uvea. And then it was back in the time of the Tuutonga. So Uvea, there was a lot of territories in the Pacific that were under the empire of the Tuutonga, or they paid tribute to the Tuutonga. Uvea and Futuna being one of them. And the theory is that this dance originated from that area in honor of the Tuutonga. And so that's why it sounds a little bit different. Either way, the lyrics and the words of the chant invokes the names of different gods in the Tongan, I would probably even say Western Pacific pantheon of gods. And you know, in the gods, there are the principal gods, that's like Tangaloa, Maui, Hikuleo, but then there are also the lesser gods. And in this chant, you hear the names of like Gololulu and Latu being invoked in the chant, along with some other ones. Hopefully that answers your question. Okay, the next question is about attire. Richard, what kind of attire did Tongans wear at the time of Mariner and before the arrival of Europeans? Okay, very good question. Let's talk about attire. And I think this applies to the rest of the Polynesian island nations around that time. The general attire for Tongans back in the time of Mariner was what we call feta'aki. And feta'aki is just tapa or ngatu without the decorations, without the dyes and the artwork that's put on it that we normally see today. Feta'aki is actually really beautiful. If you were to look at it in its natural state before they start to decorate and apply designs to it, it's a very nice off-white cream color. And for those of you who don't know, the ngatu or tapa is bark cloth. It's made from the bark of the paper mulberry tree. And this is one of those plants that was brought to the Pacific from Southeast Asia by our voyaging, our navigating ancestors, our DNA, and also just some other studies. Well, this is the prevailing theory, is that Polynesians come from Southeast Asia, from Taiwan specifically, and then they dispersed from there and came through Indonesia into Vanuatu, Tonga, Samoa, and eventually settled the Pacific. Now, there were other types of fineries worn by the chiefly class. And so those are usually, if you've seen like the really intricately weaved fine mats from Samoa. Okay, it's so fine that it almost feels like cloth. Those were the type of fineries that, you know, chiefly women had in their possession. Chiefly women in Tonga also wore these combs, or you know what we call helu, but these were combs that were made out of the tu'aniu or coconut rib, and decorated with shells and things like that. I've seen pictures of combs that were created from doa or other types of wood, but these were beautiful combs that were used as, you know, headpieces or just a head ornament. I was fortunate in 2017 to actually see what these combs look like. I was in New Zealand with my cousin, my colleague Anapesi Kaili, and we were fortunate enough to have a tour of the Pacific Collection in the Auckland Museum with our dear friend Kolokesa Mahina. And so we were able to look at some of the combs they had in their collection, and to see how beautiful they were and the craftsmanship that went into making them. And then, of course, you know, there's different types of attire or regalia that you would wear for Tongan funerals and things like that. And so I haven't seen it in the book yet. That's not to say that it's not coming up, but when it does, we will revisit this question again. Okay, here's our next question. In the last episode, you talked about Tongans being collaborative and coming together to get huge tasks done. Where did you find these Tongans, and do they actually exist? Okay, thank you for this question. And actually, this is a funny, funny, hilarious question, because we all, I'm pretty sure, have encountered that same kind of feeling at one point or the other in our lives. But what I'm referring to, and specifically looking at this one incident in the book, in the last episode, where 400 men came together to work like almost like a machine, in the way that Mariner describes it. They all just did their part to dismantle this huge ship, you know, to extract all the iron from it. And so and Mariner was just so fascinated by how quickly they were able to get this done without any complaints. They did it quietly with no kind of complaints. And I feel like this is one of the hallmarks of our Tongan culture, especially when you are thinking about Tongans as a collective. So really what Mariner was witnessing was the social organization of Tongan society coming together to get this specific task done. And that's what I'm referring to in the last episode. When you have these kind of enormous tasks, and especially tasks that have a lot of social value, like if you are expecting a royal or a chief, you know, back in those days, if there was a funeral and there are protocols to be performed, there are people in Tongan society who already have those roles and everybody knows. And so there is rarely dissension. So let's use Tauhitui for an example. And so when we know in a Tongan community that a member of the royal family or a high-ranking chief is coming to visit, okay? So let's say I'm here in Salt Lake City and it's our winter season, and let's say one of the royals is coming here because they want to go snowboarding. Okay, so we all know about it. There are chiefs here that are already in place, what we call Hoeiki or Matapule, and they come from these clans who have served these royal lines forever, okay, going back to the very first Tuitonga. And so if the word comes to us that a member of the royal family is here, every person here in the Tongan community knows how to mobilize and how to make themselves useful so that we can accomplish the task of welcoming and taking care of this member of the royal family. And so that's something I feel that's very ingrained in our DNA. And this really goes back to the days of the Tuitonga, because that was a time when people were, you know, serving in these roles, and I just feel like it's been passed down through the generations to today, and it's very impressive to me. I'm very Americanized, I will tell you that right now, but I have seen people in our community come together when it comes to these kind of things, and I'm so happy to just be a part of it. It makes you feel like you are a part of, you know, the collective. And I totally understand what Mariner was seeing, and that's what I was referring to in the last episode. Okay, the last question comes, actually several readers sent the same type of question in, and here we go. Richard, does Mariner's book mention anything about Fraleti in Tonga? And if so, were they accepted as members of society? Okay, so a quick answer is no. And I also did some research on this and found that a lot of other narratives from Europeans who were living in Tonga at the time also lack this information in their records. There just isn't any mentions or anything about whakaleiti, population, or any other kind of like gender identity. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of scholarship on this. I did some research and found a paper written by Carrie E. James from the University of Hawaii in Manoa, and the paper is called Effeminate Males and Changes in the Construction of Gender in Tonga. And he pretty much confirms this as well, that there isn't a lot of documentation based on the observations of Mariner and also other Europeans. However, there's a lot of evidence that this was pretty common in Eastern Polynesia. So like in Tahiti, in Hawaii, there are records of Mahu, and also in Hawaii, what they call Aikane, and these were men. So these were warriors who had partners who were also men, but they were also married and they had wives and they also had children. What's interesting, you know, in Tonga, in our mythologies, in our legends, we have this deity named Hikuleo, who is one of the principal gods. And so there's a lot of discussions about whether Hikuleo was male or female or intersex or even transgender. And so, you know, ancient Tongans already had these concepts of gender variation, and we just don't see that anymore. There's also a belief that Hikuleo is actually female, and that with the arrival of Christianity and the influence of Christianity, they try to change the identity of Hikuleo to a male to coincide with this new kind of patriarchy that Christianity introduced to Tongan culture. So I want to go back to the concept of Aikane, like in Hawaii that was mentioned earlier. And maybe this is where we are missing this very important detail, because we are thinking so narrowly when we are trying to define a gender or sexual identity. In our Tongan culture, anything that is outside of the binary of male-female relationship is considered, or we call it whakaleiti, or in the manner of a woman or a lady. And so this is the umbrella term that we apply to all members of the LGBTI community, whakaleiti, which is so limited and so narrow in the way that it tries to define all of that. And so I think if we are to follow this very narrow definition, we definitely miss out, you know, we have these blinders on, but then we miss out on the variety of gender expressions and sexual identity that is present in our community. And I'm wondering if this is the same thing that happened back then, is that those people who were observing, you know, so these are foreigners, but are completely unaware of how we fail he or how we interact with each other in a Tongan context. And so in a Tongan context, you know, gainga is like everything. Gainga, your family, your relationships with your family, and not just your immediate family, your extended family, the village. Everybody works for the benefit of the kainga. So regardless of what your sexual orientation or your gender expression was at the time, that had to take a backseat to the needs of the kainga. And this goes back to just the other question where we talked about the collective. You know, this is collective thinking. And I'm not saying that this is like the best thing ever. I'm just saying that this is the Tongan way of living and Tongan way of thinking. And just on a side note, I think we really need to come up with a term that is more inclusive of other gender expressions and also sexual identity. Okay, I'll end that question there because I went off topic there a little. And actually, I could do an entire show on just that alone. But to answer the question, no, Mariner didn't see a lot of that. And this is also the experience of other European explorers. And that's not to say that it didn't happen. We just don't have enough information to really answer that question. Okay, that is the end of our Q&A episode. I want to give a special thank you to Devi Takaili for sharing his knowledge with us. Thank you so much, and we appreciate it, and we'd love to have you back on the show. I want to thank all of you for supporting and for listening. Share the podcast with your friends. And once again, if you have a question, please email it to me at rwolfgram@gmail.com, or leave me a voicemail on my Google Voice number, which is 385-347-0906. Thank you so much. Si oto ofa, and we'll catch you later.